Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Jodi Picoult has written 10 New York Times number one bestsellers, including 2016's Small Great Things. Her latest book is A Spark of Light. Jodi talks this hour with Detroit News columnist Neil Rubin, who asked her when she knew that writing would work out as a career. This event was recorded at the Traverse City Opera House in October 2016.
In terms of when I realized I could actually do this for a living, it's not as long back as you would think. It was really only about, I would say, 2010 or so that I started to think, okay, I think I'm going to be okay here. And honestly, you know, a lot of reporters think I'm an overnight success, and I was not by any means an overnight success. I have been doing this for a long time. It's been 20 years, and, you know, like I said, 4 people bought my first book, but they told their friends about it, so the next book 8 people bought. And then, like, it continued to exponentially increase. So, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful to readers because the way I got to where I am was not through Oprah. It was not by word of mouth. I mean, it was not by marketing. It was by word of mouth. And that's the only kind of advertising you can't buy. So, you know, in a way, I feel like I came by it honestly, and I'm really grateful to the readers for that.
Well, and we also talked about affirmation. You know, there's a lot of people counting on you now from the publisher on down. Oh, Jodi's got a new book coming out. What's the benchmark of success for you? And, you know, is it important to debut that high on the bestseller list? Do you track the bestseller list?
I could be super humble and say, no, it's about the act of writing, but that's a total lie. So I'm going to tell you, I did not expect this book to hit number one. And there are a lot of reasons why, many of which include the fact that the fall is the hardest time to publish a book. Mm. There are some incredible literary writers out there. Everybody who's a big commercial writer has a book out. And, you know, trying to find a space where your book is going to be the number one book is really, really hard. And I very much had resigned myself to not debuting at number one. And I was very cranky about it, as anyone at my publishing company can tell you. And what really upset me was that of all my books, I so badly wanted this one to be number one, because it really is a book that I wish would start, and hopefully will start, a global conversation across this country. And to be able to do that as a commercially successful author, not just a literary author, meant a lot to me. So to be totally honest, I found out that this hit number one when I was literally checking a bag in at an airport, which is all I do these days. And my phone was ringing, and I couldn't answer it because I was putting this very heavy bag on a scale and sweating out the 50 pounds. And so my publicist was next to me, and her phone's blowing up, and she's going, pick up your phone, pick up your phone, pick up your phone. And I finally grabbed it, and I had about 30,000 texts from my editor saying, we're number one, we're number one. And I wrote back, how? I mean, like, the math didn't make sense. And she wrote back, who cares? So,
yes, that's the proper answer. Yeah. Who cares? But it's also important to note, refreshing, I think, that even after selling 35 million books, Jodi worries about getting under that 50-pound limit at the airport.
I do. Totally.
You know, the writing process, we know Winston Churchill wrote standing up. Everybody, this being a Michigan audience, we all know about Elmore Leonard and his special-ordered, unlined legal pads on which he wrote longhand. Where do you write, and do you keep yourself to a schedule? Are you punching a clock? Is it, you know, hours or pages per day?
Mm-hmm. I write on the third floor of my house, which is the attic. It was the last room in our house that we finished. So for many, many years, and I mean, I'm talking up until 2 years ago, we would have reporters come to do stories on me, and they would say, can we take pictures of you in your office? And we would go upstairs to the sheetrock and plaster and, you know, and boxes all over the place. And then they would go, could we maybe go somewhere else? And we'd wind up in my husband's office. My husband doesn't even need an office, but he was an antiques dealer, so it looks beautiful. And and they would take pictures of me there. And finally, my husband said, this is really stupid. We need to finish this room. So I have a very beautiful office now that is on the gable end of the house, and one whole wall of it is a curly maple desk. So my computer's on there, my printer's on there, and then the rest of the desk is filled with piles of research so that I can grab anything I need to for any particular book that I'm working on. Right across from it, behind me, are just shelves with tons of stacks of books and books in progress, manuscripts, other projects that I'm working on. Everything is very tidy and easily accessible, unless I'm in the middle of a book, in which case everything's all over the place. But.
And where does Dudley sit?
Dudley comes and visits sometimes. Dudley's one of my four dogs. He's my oldest dog. He is the dog that is always in every media opportunity. He's always in the photos, and he's a beautiful dog. But he'll come upstairs usually if he thinks I'm eating something. Yeah.
Well, I think you've partially answered a question that I was curious about. As a columnist, people always want to know how many columns I am ahead, as though I've got six on a shelf that I can just pull off if I want to go play golf. And the actual answer
is...
Yeah,
I have 16 books I could just pull off a shelf.
Oh, right.
Right off.
Totally. Yeah. You know, how far ahead do I work? About 45 minutes. And, but in your case, especially as heavily researched as your books tend to be, are you working on book B, researching or laying out the bones of book B while you're still writing book A?
Usually I am. And, you know, what I usually say is I'm not actively writing more than one book at a time, and that's already a lie, because when I was writing the young adult series with my daughter, I was simultaneously writing adult novels. And, you know, the YA series is very light and sweet and funny, and I was writing that with this book and with The Storyteller, which are the two most tragic books. One's about the Holocaust and one's about racism. So it was like whiplash going from one book to the other. But very often I will be in the process of editing a book, researching a new one, writing a different one, like all three of those. But I always see it like windows on the computer. You can click on one so it's in front of you, but you can't have them all open at the same time. And I really try not to actively write two books if I can help it, and I'm not working with my daughter. But then there are other projects as well. We're in the process of turning Between the Lines into a Broadway musical. So that is something I'm helping to write. That takes up a lot of time and a lot of energy, and that's a whole different project. When I was writing the Wonder Woman series, I was doing that simultaneously while I was writing books. So writing can take lots of different forms, but novels I tend to do one at a time. And it is worth noting, particularly for this book, because I'm sure someone's got this question in the audience, I am usually knee-deep in the research for my new novel by the time I go out to tour for one that has just been published. And I have not started the research for my next novel. I know what I'm writing about. I'm not telling you. But I know it's coming, but I can't let go of this book. This book changed me in ways that no other book has. And I can't let go of this conversation, and I can't let go of these characters yet.
Which is a wonderful thing, as you will all discover. I suspect everybody is either clutching a book or will. And... Well, before we get to the book, it was going to be such a smooth transition to the book. You were going to be dazzled by the transition. But you're doing a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
Have you always wanted to flex that muscle? Did the opportunity just jump up? How'd that come about?
So you heard one of my pet projects at home in New Hampshire. I executive produce a teen theater group that performs original musicals that are written by my best friend, who is a composer, and myself. And I write the book of the show as well as the lyrics. She does the music. They're full-length musicals. Several of them are licensable for other schools and organizations and have been performed as far away as New Zealand and Zambia. And we perform these with a group of 40 teens to raise money for local charities in our area, our hometown. And so I've been involved in theater since my kids were little and wanted to get involved. And that was my way of creating musical theater for them, because a program like that didn't exist where I was living for that age. But when I wrote Between the Lines, I felt like it sang. And I really wanted to not just adapt this for a teen audience that I was going to perform in a little town in New Hampshire. I really was thinking big. And I did my homework because I knew nothing about Broadway musicals. And I was very fortunate when I got an honorary doctorate from Dartmouth, this man came up to me and he said, my wife is such a huge fan of yours. And I said, oh, well, where is she? I'd love to say hi. And he said, well, she's at the Tonys. And I went, what? And she is this very, very esteemed producer. Her name is Daryl Roth. And I sent her a book and a thank you note. And she wrote me back and said, you know, if you ever want to see one of my shows, please let me know. My kids went and saw The Normal Heart when she was producing it. She's won about like 7 or 8 Tonys. She is also the producer of Kinky Boots. I went to see that. I took friends to see it. I met her. And eventually, when I knew I wanted to do this, I asked her for advice. And she was very gracious in explaining to me how you go about turning something into a musical. I knew right away I was going to have to find composers, a composer and lyricist, and I did. I found 2 young women who were coming through the advanced stages of the BMI workshop in New York, which is where composers are born. And they are so good, in fact, that they've been hired by Disney now on the strength of our songs from the musical. And we've had a terrific run for 2 years. We're working at a breakneck pace. We have a terrific book writer named Tim McDonald, who has written a bunch of shows, most recently James and the Giant Peach. And working on this is like, it's like when you run every day and then you decide to go swimming. You're getting a lot of exercise, but you're using totally different muscles. And it's so much fun for me. It's like, it doesn't feel like work. It actually feels like play.
It's a new hobby.
Yeah, it is my new hobby. Don't tell my husband, but yeah.
Hey, at least you didn't buy a boat. Wait, you already have a boat.
He has a boat. Oh, I have nothing to do with a boat. That's his hobby, fishing.
I'm intrigued by the idea of, you know, you heard the character sing. When you write, can you hear, you know, your dialogue is very different with the characters in every book. Do you hear the character's voice?
100%. That's actually how it starts for me. I usually start with something that is upsetting me. That's the genesis of a book for me, something that keeps me up at night. If I keep thinking about it and thinking about it, characters pop up and begin to take a story away from me. And they literally start talking to me. And I've long said that the difference between writing and schizophrenia is a paycheck.
So they speak to you and they say, write me, write me.
Mm-hmm.
When you set out, for instance, with Small Great Things, you have an issue. In this case, and I'm going to ask you to talk about that, you have a specific news event that jump-started this book.
Right.
By the time you sit down to write, do you know where the book is going to end, or do you just push the characters out the door and see where they lead you?
I know the beginning of the book, and I know the end of the book. What I don't know is how I'm going to get from A to Z, and that really is completely driven by the characters. And I've learned over 20 years to stop forcing them places. I just sort of sit back and hold on to the reins and see where they take me.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Neil Rubin's conversation with Jodi Picco.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Neil Rubin of the Detroit News talking with author Jodi Picco.
The event that launched Small Great Things.
Yes. Well, this is actually a longer explanation, but I tried to write about racism 25 years ago. I was living in New York City, and there was a news story about an African-American undercover cop who had been shot 4 times in the back by his white colleagues, even though he was wearing a wristband called the Color of the Day that identified him as an undercover cop. And this really rattled me. And I wanted to write this story. And I started, and I failed miserably. I just could not create an authentic story. I couldn't create authentic characters. And I really doubted myself. I thought, you know, is this even my story to write? I am very obviously a white woman. What on earth do I have to say about racism? How could I possibly tap into that? And over the years, every time I thought about writing about race again, I would play devil's advocate. And I would say, you know, you write all the time as people you're not. You write as men. You write as Holocaust survivors. You write as school shooters. You're none of those people. So why is this different? Well, because race is different. Racism is different. It's really, really hard to talk about without offending someone. And as a result, we often just don't talk about it at all. So fast forward to 2012. And in Flint, Michigan, there was an African-American nurse with 20 years of labor and delivery experience who helped deliver a baby. And in the aftermath, that baby's father called in her supervisor and said, "I don't want her or anyone who looks like her touching my baby." The hospital, then he pushed up his sleeve to reveal a swastika tattoo, important detail. Then the hospital put a post-it note on the baby's file saying no African-American personnel to touch this infant. As a result, the nurse and several colleagues of color banded together and they sued the hospital. And in fact, they settled out of court. And I really hope that she got a giant payout. I don't know. But I do know that I believe in the audience tonight is the lawyer who represented her, which is very exciting because I can't wait to meet her. And but this news story really arrested me again, caught my eye. And I began to think, okay, what if? What if this situation had been different? What if there had been an African-American nurse with 20 years of labor and delivery experience that this happened to, but then she was alone with that baby when something went wrong? What if she had to choose between saving the baby's life or disobeying her supervisor's orders? What if she wound up on trial and was defended by a white public defender who, like me, like a lot of my friends, would never consider herself to be a racist? And what if I could tell the story in three points of view? The African-American nurse, the white public defender, and the skinhead dad, as they all began to unravel their beliefs about race and power and privilege. And suddenly it was like this lock turned, the key turned in the lock. I knew I was gonna finish this book. And it was because things had changed. My focus was different and my audience was different. I wasn't trying to write a book about racism to tell people of color how hard their lives are. That's not my story to tell, and it never will be. And to be completely honest, there are so many amazing authors of color who are telling that story beautifully every day without any interference from me. I was writing to people who look like me to say it's really easy to point to a skinhead and say, that's a racist. But it's much harder to point to ourselves and say the same thing.
And did it help any that the fact is now you're someone who sold 35 million books? Does it make it easier to say, well, if my audience doesn't buy into this the way I hope they will, and clearly they have, mm-hmm. does it make it easier to say this is important, it needs to be written, I'm just going to write it?
The truth is that when I write a book, I don't think about anyone who's reading it. I'm so sorry, but I don't. I actually think about what I need to write. And this was a book I needed to write because I spent 47 years not talking about race. You know why? Because I don't have to. And that's a privilege.
Yes.
You know, and I didn't realize that. And I began to realize for me as I started this journey that I needed to figure out my biases. I needed to understand who I was and where my shortcomings were before I asked any readers to do it. And I really did think that if I was willing to go through that process, then surely my readers could too, because I'd done it first. You know, I'm here to say I'm still here. I'm still standing. I learned a lot. And, you know, and I would like to believe that I think my readers trust me, no matter how difficult the subject is. They know I'm going to do the research. They know I'm going to lead them through both sides of the argument so that they can make an educated and informed decision by the end of the book. And I would hope that even though this is a difficult conversation, they feel the same way. But even more to the point, using fiction as a vehicle to enter a conversation about race is actually critical. It's really hard to go up to someone whose beliefs are different from yours or who isn't ready to take a journey on this, you know, path yet and to say, let's talk about racism.
Yes.
You know, they're going to shut down. Well, there's this magical thing that happens with fiction. If you give a book to someone, you're not saying, let's talk about race. You're saying, hey, let's talk about the story. Great book. I think you're really going to like it. And you start talking about the characters and the situations who are, of course, quote, made up. But then you segue into, you know, I saw this thing on the news that was kind of like this. And all of a sudden, you are having a conversation about real life, but it's a little gentler. You know, and if I can give this book as a springboard, if I can help people who, like me, don't have a vocabulary to talk about racism, find the right words and find a way into this discussion that we as white people need to be having among ourselves, then I feel like I've done the right thing.
Yeah, it is so easy. You know, I've worked in Detroit, downtown, for 32 years, and I'm stunned. I still meet people who, our first meeting, start throwing around racial slurs. Hmm. And I said, did you not get the memo? You know, we've turned a few calendar pages here. Mm-hmm. But what it tells you is they think like that, and they're so comfortable. They're surrounded by people who think like that. So they're completely comfortable tossing those words out. And like you said, that's the overt racism. Yeah, we can see that. It's the other stuff that you have to dig a little bit to find. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the research for this book. And all of your books are very carefully researched. And I understand your research department is here with us tonight.
That's me. Yeah, that's it. You got it.
You know, some people truly do hire researchers, and there's not one thing wrong with that, but
I'm it. Yeah. I'm a one-woman show. It's true. But for me, you know, this, I needed to do this research. I mean, for many reasons, not just so that I could write the book, but so that I could learn. And I did. I learned a colossal amount writing this book. I started off by reading everything I could by racial justice educators so that I could have the right terminology and words. Then I decided I was going to go to a racial justice workshop. And I thought, how hard could this be? I'm a good person. I'm a nice person. I'm open-minded. Well, I left every night in tears, every single night. And it was really devastating to listen to the stories of people of color that I never had really thought about before. There was this Asian American woman who stood up in tears talking about her love-hate relationship with eyeliner because she had trouble putting it on her features, but it was the standard of beauty she'd grown up with. There was an African American woman who stood up and said, every morning she has to get up and put on a mask, you know, a metaphorical mask, so that she can go into the world and be the kind of black person other people can handle. And just once, she'd like to be herself. And I will never have to have either of those problems. And that was a big moment for me to learn. Then, when I knew I was going to be writing The Voice of Ruth, I sat down with a group of women of color who were kind enough to overlook my ignorance about their lives and their upbringing and spent 100 hours of interview tape talking to me about their hopes and their fears and their failures and their successes and, again, their stories. So there was the woman who just had the cutest baby in the world, her second son, and she came in with him on her hip the morning after there was another shooting by an unarmed African-American man, by a policeman. And she came in tears, and she said, how am I going to keep him safe when he's older? How do I teach him to not be black? What do you say to that? There was the young girl who had graduated from Vassar College who brought her water bottle with her that said Vassar on it. And whenever she rode public transportation, she would take it with her and put the word Vassar facing out so that as white people walked by the empty seat, they would know she was safe. And that story actually did wind up going into the book as well. And these women went one step further, and a few of them became my sensitivity readers. So they read the work in progress. They read the manuscript. They told me when Ruth sounded right and what I had to do to make her sound right. And to be honest, their voices are Ruth's. And I couldn't have written the book without them. I shouldn't have written the book without them. And then the last big hurdle of research that I had to do was to create the voice of a skinhead. So I met with two former skinheads. One is a guy named Tim Zoll. He grew up in Orange County, and he ran with a super violent crew in Orange County. And at one point with his crew, he beat up and left for dead a gay man on the curb. And years later, he got out of the movement. First thing he did was write a letter to the rabbi of the director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Because when he had been in his heyday as a skinhead, he wrote a letter to this guy that was super offensive, and he wanted to apologize. And the rabbi wrote him back and said, why don't you come work for me? And so he did, and he would talk about leaving a life of hate. Well, one day he looks up in the cafeteria, and there's the guy he beat up and left for dead, who is now a docent at the Simon Wiesenthal Center. So they look at each other, they're stunned. They wound up over a period of months having conversations, apologizing, giving forgiveness, building a new relationship. They are friends now. They spend holidays at each other's houses, and they give talks every day together about their story. The other man that I spoke with is a guy named Frankie Mink. He grew up in Philadelphia and ran a very violent skinhead crew. And he went to jail at one point as a skinhead. And when he was there, he realized that the African-American kids were the ones he really kind of gelled with. They went to Bible study together. They talked about the girls they missed outside and the food that they missed outside. When he got out of jail, one of his first jobs was to work for a Jewish man. And he had been told his whole life that Jewish people were cheap and stingy and would try to cheat you out of money. So the night before his contract ended, he got called into his boss's office. And he's thinking, here it comes, he's going to stiff me. And the guy said to him, you've done such a great job, I'd like to pay you double. And he began to realize how many exceptions to the rule did there have to be before the rules need changing. And now both of these men work with the government to try to ferret out skinheads who no longer look the way they used to look. They're not bald and wearing their Doc Martens and suspenders. They actually look like you and me. And they spend most of their time online trying to incite hate and fear that way. They will go into communities and make it look like there are more of them than there actually are. They might go to a temple and put the final call from the Nation of Islam under all the windshields, for example. And their whole point is to spread fear and hate. But they do still stockpile weapons in the hills of places like New Hampshire, where I live. And they have Aryan Independence Days and Hitler's birthday festivals where you can go and pitch a tent and get tattoos and listen to white power bands. And your kids can play games like Pin the Star on the Jew. Or there's a noose pinata with an African-American man in a noose that they can hit. You can also go target shooting. And the targets are profiles of Martin Luther King Jr. and President Obama. And I urge you to remember it's 2016 and someone is making those materials.
That's one of the things that floors me, is that there's a factory churning those out.
And that's right.
And you live in New Hampshire.
I do.
And I did not have this fact at hand. I looked it up. The African-American population
is very small.
1.1%.
It's the second whitest state in America.
Yes. Yep. Tell him I said hi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know.
Has there been, you know, sort of in your peer group as you were working on this book, was there understanding of the need, or in a setting like that, do people sort of feel insulated from the problems that are always in Ferguson or someplace else?
There is even more of a need, actually. And I'll say this, first of all, that this is a novel. No matter who reads this novel, you're going to enjoy it because of the characters and the situations and you know, the twists and everything else that I usually would give you in a book. But I will acknowledge that if you're a person of color and you're reading this, it's going to feel different than if you're a white person. And the response that I've gotten from people of color has been great. It has been, this reminds me of when this happened to me. And they're sharing their stories of microaggressions and macroaggressions with me. I'll tell you about one of them. There was a woman who wrote me and said she was an ASL interpreter, which is a very white space to begin with. She was asked to interpret at a church, and she was signing in the front row, and this woman, a white woman, said very loudly, will you please tell her to stop? I can't look at her black face. And because it was her job, she actually had to sign those words. And, you know, she was obviously devastated and really, really hurt. Another woman wrote me, a professional woman who had a master's degree, I can't remember in what, and she said that reading this book reminded her of how her mother used to say there was a black tax, which was you had to be that much better to be considered on par with other people who were white. So I think that the people of color who are reading this are seeing themselves, hopefully seeing that I tried very hard to write authentically and compassionately a voice of color, as well as I could, using people who were people of color to help me. And also I hope that they're saying, I'm really glad you started this conversation, that's cool. White people are having a very different reaction to this. And they are really having a hard time, which is great. You know, it is a tough read because you realize you'll catch yourself saying, oh, I do that too. And maybe I shouldn't do that. And what I really think it's encouraging people to do is to start a discussion with other people who look like them. That is critical. And that's really what I learned when I was doing all this research, when I wrote this book, this is what I learned. Even if we don't talk about racism because we're scared, that doesn't mean we're not part of the problem. Racism is not an African-American problem. It's actually a white problem. And we should be talking about it in places where there are no people of color, because it's that important. And that's what allies do. Allies talk to the people who look like them. I realize, too, that although it's really easy for us to see the headwinds of racism, you know, the ways that it's harder as a person of color to achieve success, it's really difficult for us to accept that there are tailwinds of racism. There are opportunities that we have because of our lighter skin that we like to attribute to luck or hard work, and that's why we were successful. When in reality, very often, it's because you had an opportunity someone of color did not. And it could be something you don't even know about. It could be something like, you know, oh, you got an apartment because your landlord didn't want to rent to somebody black, and you got, you know, you may never have known that, but you still got the place to live. But it also could be something that you attribute to your own hard work, like going to a great school. You know, you worked hard, you did well in school, you got great grades on your SATs. Or was it because your mom was there when you were a tiny kid to read to you every night and to build that foundation, and a person of color's mom was working three jobs and wasn't there to do that and was playing catch up his whole life? And when you begin to unpack that a little bit, you know, that American dream looks a little less dreamy. But, you know, above all else, if I could say anything to the people who are going to be reading this book, it's talk about this stuff. Talk about it and know you're going to make a mistake. I'm going to make mistakes. We're all going to make mistakes. It's still better to say, I'm so sorry. Thank you for telling me. I'm learning from that, and I'm going to move forward, than to not say anything at all.
Right. And there are multiple instances in the book, and I feel like I'm, you know, more attuned than the average honky, you know, just having been a newspaper columnist in Detroit but I realize I see things that I, from reading your book, I didn't see as, oh, by golly, it's not blatant, but it's right there.
Right.
And, you know, I look back on when I was a young sports writer, and I remember describing several football players over the years as articulate. I bet they weren't white football players.
Yep.
You know, it's, oh, yep. God, you know, and so what you're saying is, gee, I'm surprised.
Right.
And of course you shouldn't be. And something that jumped out at me in the book, Edison
he's my favorite character.
He is the accomplished son of Ruth, the 20-year experienced nurse. And at one point, his mother's on the phone. Yeah. And she gets off the phone and he says, were you talking to a white person? And she says, well, yes, why? And he said, your voice changes. Or how did you know your voice changes?
Right.
Who told you that? And was it expressed as a necessity or something she felt badly about having done?
No, it was one of the women of color that I was doing interviews with. And a lot of the women that I spoke with were very much like Ruth in that their decisions had been guided by their desire to give a better life to their kids. And it was their own definition of a better life. They didn't ask their kids about that. And so, you know, they were educated. One woman got bused 2 hours to an elite Jewish private school, which was predominantly white, from Harlem, which is where she was living as a kid, just so that she could go to that school. So 4 hours round trip every day. And then she wound up getting a degree at a college. She lived in a very white neighborhood, and she did that because she wanted her kids to go to a white, predominantly white school, but she didn't want their friends to be able to say, oh, I can't go to your house to play because you don't live in a good neighborhood. If they all live in the same neighborhood, that's not an excuse anymore. You know, so all of these things were things that these women told me about, and all of them had very similar experiences to Ruth, where they were almost, I call it like flying under the radar of white society. You know, choosing to be the only black face in a sea of white at your particular place of business, for example. Choosing to live in a white community rather than a predominantly African-American community. And the interesting thing is that Ruth does not realize what's been lost by doing that. And she has lost a lot of her culture and a lot of her support system as a result of that.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Jodi Picoult reads from her book, Small Great Things.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Neil Rubin's conversation with Jodi Picoult.
Do you go through life copy-editing the world?
I'm definitely not a copy editor because I don't understand copy editors. They are like a rare breed. They are really strange. They're the people who say, you know, your character got up from bed on page 46 and left the house on page 49, but he wasn't wearing pants. Like, they say stuff like that all the time. Can I tell you the funniest copy editing note from this book? Kennedy has an assistant who's working with her in her public defender's office, and he's a young kid who's fresh out of law school. And when she asks him how old he is, he says 20-something, and she says, oh, I have sweaters older than you are. And the copy editor actually wrote a note in the margin saying, technically, if Kennedy is 35 years old, she wouldn't be able to fit into a sweater that was 20 years old. And I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. Isn't that great?
That is just marvelous.
Yeah.
God bless him.
I know.
But, you know, for instance, if I'm reading a restaurant menu, and it says fresh fish.
Right.
You know, it's like, ooh, it's, you know, illegal use of quotation marks. Let's move on. And
right.
I noticed that you, particularly in dialogue with Ruth, but then later on without, capitalize the word black.
Yes, that is a very intentional decision. And the difference is different characters in this book either capitalize or do not capitalize black. In Ruth's section, it is capitalized. That is how most racial justice educators do it, and they are recognizing the fact that that the term for a community of black people, it used to actually be capitalized. It was part of the New York Times Standard, and then it got dropped somehow. And I think that punctuation can often be a descriptor and also a measure of power. And I thought that it was fair that Ruth would definitely want that capitalized. Then I went with the traditional, Chicago Manual of Style for Kennedy. And, of course, then there's Turk, who would think the other way, and White would be capitalized.
Turk is a very interesting character. I don't know how many people will come up and say, oh, Turk was my favorite character. I hope it's a very small number.
Me too, yeah.
But you have a way of taking people who would be inherently unsympathetic, the school shooter in 19 Minutes, and if not making them sympathetic, at least making them understood.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it's a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a process to that?
Yeah, I don't believe anybody is 100%. I think everyone is flawed. Okay, I need to know, how many people here watched the Hamilton documentary? Did anyone watch it on PBS? Okay, I may be a little obsessed with Hamilton. And one of the things that that I think Chris Jackson, who plays Washington, says, is he's talking about his portrayal of Washington and how Washington was both an incredible leader and a really important statesman in America, but he also owned slaves. You know, he definitely was a problematic individual. And then Lin-Manuel Miranda says, I think our show does a really good job of basically making sure no one is just one thing. I think he's the one who says it. And that's, you know, look, none of us are just one thing, ever. And, you know, if you're judged by one act on one day of your life, people are going to think very differently than if they get to know you over the course of your entire life. Turk has done some truly hideous and heinous things. And when you read him, know that everything Turk does really happened to one of those two men that I interviewed. And know that I cut 80 pages of Turk's narrative. So there was a lot more in there. And, you know, yet something happens to Turk very early on in the book that is probably the worst tragedy I can imagine. And you will feel compassion for him because of it.
And did you set that up, obviously. Mm-hmm. You said, okay, this will happen to him.
Right.
But, you know, it's wonderfully effective. It's also, you know, and again, a hallmark of effective writing, it can be somewhat excruciating.
Yeah, every time I wrote Turk, I literally had to go downstairs and take a shower. Because I really felt dirty writing him, and I was angry at myself because I would get to the point where I could write the N-word, and it didn't even faze me. I didn't go like that at my seat. I became too close to him when I was writing him, and it made me sick.
Yeah, as a reader, as good as that material was,
it's hard.
I'm glad you left out at least some of those 80 pages, because it's intense.
Right. And it's really important. It's really important to remember when you read this, that wasn't fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A fictional moment, or at least a phrase, something that just I loved. And throughout your books, you know, it's very hard to make it look easy. And there's one, not quite throwaway line, but just a casual line in there. It's on page 291, if you have that memorized.
Of course.
And I'm not going to give away exactly what's going on here, because it's a plot point, and we don't like to do spoilers here. But a character is saying, I don't have the words to tell her what it really feels like, what it's like being the balloon when someone lets go of the string. You're allowed to applaud. That's a wonderful line.
Thank you. thank you.
Did that just sort of fall out of your fingertips? Or did you try three or four different things and go back to that, settle on that?
You know, it's really interesting. When I think about my career as a writer and how I've grown and changed as a writer, I do not believe I've changed much in terms of plot and character development. I think that was pretty standard when I started out 25 years ago. What has gotten better for me is the technical act of writing. Hmm. And I know this from reading my earlier books. I know that where it might have taken me a paragraph to make that metaphor work, I can now do it in 5 words. And I think that's, honestly, that's just practice. Usually, especially with Ruth, you know, very intentionally, when you are writing multiple narrators, what you do as a writer is make sure that their syntax is different too.
Yes.
If you look at any page in the book, you should be able to open it up and know who's talking, whether it's Ruth or Kennedy or Turk. Turk is very subject, verb, object. He's very simplistic in the way he speaks. He's not going to have any flowery language. Ruth has the most beautiful and incisive metaphors. All the good ones go to her. And and honestly, I think it feels to me when I'm writing different narrators, like there's a stream and the stream is the narrative. And then there are different pairs of Wellington boots lined up. And when you step into them, they're going to feel a little different on your feet. And then you put your feet into the stream and you pick it up at the point where your feet enter the stream. And that's, you know, the narrative, and that's what's going to be whatever story you're telling, but you're telling it in terms of how those boots fit on you. It's a weird metaphor, but it's really the way it feels to me. And so I think when I get into the mindset of a particular character, I don't feel like I'm crafting for them. I just feel like I'm listening.
That's so splendid.
<Thank you. laughs>
that I love the Wellingtons, and I could see where just, you know, as a private joke, as a wink to the people in this room, Use that in a book sometime.
Okay. All right. And I'll be like, hey, Traverse City, remember that?
Yo, shout out to Traverse City. There's another point in the book where Kennedy, the public defender, who's a wonderful character, is getting a massage. It's a gift from her mother. And she is proudly the world's worst massage subject or patient. Yes. She can't stop talking about work, thinking about work. And then at the end, she says, she sort of murmurs, and unfortunately, I didn't write that one down verbatim, you know, I'm not any good at yoga either.
Yeah.
Is that you?
So me. That actually is totally me. So I have to tell you, I went to this yoga class with one of my friends, and it was held at our public library, and I called it yoga for the nearly dead because that's about how intense it was. And I'm like, when I'm doing something, I want to sweat, I want to work out, and I wasn't really doing that there. And I swear women would fall asleep on either side of me, you know, during the final poses. And, you're supposed to be at the very end, you do child's pose, which feels really good, and you're supposed to be emptying your mind of everything, and I make lists. All I do is make lists. So I can't do yoga. And someone told me I should do Pilates because it's yoga without that. But we'll see.
Well, I think it would be a dandy thing for people here to hear you do a reading.
Sure.
Is there a passage or two that...
Yes. I'm actually going to read to you from Ruth at the very beginning, so I'm not giving anything away. But it will give you a sense of who this very incredible woman is.
She really is incredible. She's just an admirable person.
She's an awesome character.
Yeah.
She's a really awesome character. And and actually, we haven't talked about this at all yet, but I might as well also throw this out there. What I love about Ruth is that one of the things I learned when I was doing this research is that in a court of law, one of the easiest ways to lose your case is to bring up race. And it's because you don't know what your jury is thinking about race. You don't know what your judge is thinking about race. Everyone has implicit biases. Everyone walks in with an agenda, even if they think they're not racist, they are if they're white anyway. And if you look at the trajectory of court cases, even the ones that are racially motivated, people who are lawyers will try to acquit without mentioning race or bringing up race. A really great example of this would be the George Zimmerman trial after Trayvon Martin shooting, which is mentioned in here. The judge actually prohibited the term racial profiling from being uttered in court. And it's pretty clear that was racially motivated shooting. What I love is that one of the barriers between Ruth and Kennedy is that Kennedy's job is to get Ruth off any way she can. And she thinks she can do it, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with race. Yes. But for Ruth, it's not about an acquittal. It's about a principle. And that's one of the reasons I love her so much.
She is a stand-up person.
So this is Ruth. The most beautiful baby I ever saw was born without a face. From the neck down, he was perfect. 10 fingers, 10 toes, chubby belly. But where his ears should have been, there was a twist of lips and a single tooth. Instead of a face, there was a swirling eddy of skin. His mother, my patient, had received prenatal care, including an ultrasound, but the baby had been positioned in a way that the facial deformity hadn't been visible. No one was expecting this. Maybe for that very reason, she chose to deliver at our little cottage hospital and not Yale New Haven, which is better equipped for emergencies. She labored for 16 hours before she delivered. The doctor lifted the baby, and there was nothing but silence. "Is he all right?" the mother asked, panicking. "Why isn't he crying?" The OB silently met my gaze and turned back to the parents. In soft words, he said their child had profound birth defects that were incompatible with life. On a birth pavilion, death is a more common patient than you'd think. When we have anencephalies or fetal deaths, we know the parents still have to bond with and mourn for that baby. So I cleaned him and swaddled him the way I would any newborn, while the conversation behind me stopped and started like a car choking through winter. Questions no one ever wants to ask, and no one ever wants to answer. His mother was still crying when I settled the baby in the crook of her elbow, his tiny hands windmilled. She wore an expression I've only seen in paintings in museums, of a love and a grief so fierce that they forged together to create some new raw emotion. I turned to the father. "Would you like to hold your son?" He looked like he was about to be sick. "I can't." He bolted from the room. I cornered him in the parents' lounge. "Your wife and son need you." That's not my son. That thing is not going to be on this earth for very long, which means you better give him all the love you had stored up for his lifetime right now. When we entered the hospital room, his wife was still nuzzling the infant. I took the tiny bundle from her arms and handed the baby to her husband. I thought about my actions, you know, if I did the right thing, if it was my place. When the father started to cry, the sob shook his body like a hurricane bends a tree. He sank down beside his wife on the hospital bed. They took turns holding their son for 10 hours. That mother, she even tried to let him nurse. I couldn't stop staring because it was the most remarkable thing I'd ever seen. Love has nothing to do with what you're looking at, and everything to do with who's looking. When the infant died, it was peaceful. We made casts of the newborn's hand and foot for the parents to keep. I heard the same couple came back 2 years later and delivered a healthy daughter. It just goes to show you, every baby is born beautiful. It's what we project on them that makes them ugly.
That is,
thank you.
And I believe, why don't we raise the lights, toss it open to a couple of questions, right there.
I just have to tell you, the book was so powerful, and I wouldn't be here except my sister lives in Traverse City, and we decided, oh, let's do this thing. So I read the book, and I'm telling you, every person needs to read this book. It is so powerful.
Thank you so much.
And everyone
Thank
should
you.
Read it. Every white person, let's put it that way.
Thank you.
Listen, and I can tell you, you're not the only person, you're far from the only person who will be or has been moved to tears.
Yeah. So. And that's a really, really good first step. That's called empathy, basically. You know, and now that you know this, keep talking. Keep the conversation going. Every way that you can have that conversation, do it. And here's a super easy way to make it a very simple change. For every white author book you pick up, go back to a bookstore and pick up one by an author of color.
Yeah, go ahead and clap. Don't let me step on the applause. They're available in every genre. You know,
yeah,
if you
totally.
Read mysteries, go way back to Donald Goen.
Walter Mosley.
Walter Mosley, yeah. Absolutely. I believe our work here is done. Thank you. You've been wonderful.
Thank you. See you
Thank
in the
you,
lobby.
Doug and Ann Stanton.
That was Jodi Picoult talking with Neil Rubin. Jodi Picoult's latest book is A Spark of Light. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.